Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radio Lab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radio Lab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And if you thought the first 3 days of a Trump administration would be just ceremonial and uneventful, well, I don't know anyone who thought that anyway, so forget that premise. But the wild ride has begun with an unprecedented populist inaugural address, an unprecedented global day of protest on Trump's first full day in office, and maybe a more precedented first weekend smackdown between the White House and the Washington Press Corps, precedented for Trump at least. Lost, in my opinion, by the media's intense reaction to being lied to about crowd size, was that the new president has already made a few telling policy moves. He issued an incomprehensible executive order about Obamacare, which might have a huge impact on our medical lives, or it might not. He reversed an Obama order from just last week that had lowered interest rates for certain homeowners on their mortgage insurance. He delayed a court date in the case of a Texas voting rights case, indicating that the administration may switch sides in the case from the Obama position, and he responded to a petition on the White House website about releasing his tax returns through his aide, Kellyanne Conway.
The White House response is that he's not going to release his tax returns. We litigated this all through the election. People didn't care. They voted for him. And let me make this very clear. Most Americans are very focused on what their tax returns will look like while President Trump is in office, not what his look like.
Kellyanne Conway yesterday on ABC This Week. The promise to release the tax returns when the IRS completes its audit has now been rescinded, as you heard. The new position on the tax returns, how about never? How does never work for you? Our first guest today is a new member of the WNYC family, Charlie Sykes, who will be hosting the Wednesday night edition of our new nighttime national call-in show called Indivisible, which will air Monday through Thursday nights for the first 100 days of the Trump administration. We'll tell you more about Indivisible later. For the last 23 years, Charlie Sykes has been probably the most influential talk show host in the state of Wisconsin. With his show on WTMJ in Milwaukee, he was an anti-Trump conservative in 2016, and at the end of the year, he retired from his Wisconsin show. Charlie, thanks so much for joining us this morning, and I'm really looking forward to your new show. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Want to start with a little introduction of yourself before we jump into the news of the new administration. You are a famous conservative talk show host. I see you've been a big supporter in Wisconsin of Speaker Paul Ryan and Governor Scott Walker, including Walker's controversial rolling back of collective bargaining for public employees. So why did you take an anti-Trump position on your show, and why did you stick with it to the end when a lot of other reluctant conservatives eventually got on board?
Yes, well, I describe myself these days as a contrarian conservative, feeling somewhat in exile from the conservative movement. The guys that you mentioned, I've known for many, many, many years. But the reality is that my problem with Donald Trump is twofold. Number one, I don't believe that he's an actual conservative. And number two, maybe even more important than that, is I just think it's a matter of character that the man is and I argued this very early when he came down the golden escalator, that the man is an erratic, thin-skinned narcissist who ought not to be trusted with the nuclear codes. So, for months I was waiting and hoping for people to come to their senses, that that the conservatives would not, in fact, lose their minds. And of course, I was unsuccessful. I was hoping that Wisconsin was going to be a firewall of rationality. Instead, we were barely a speed bump.
Did you yourself vote for Hillary Clinton?
No, I actually wrote in Evan McMullen.
Aha, the former CIA employee who was running as an independent. So being
Correct. From
Wisconsin, you were in one of those states that shocked the world by going for Trump when it was supposed to be a Democratic firewall. I'm curious if you had any inkling from your callers or any other indication that it was coming.
Yes and no. What did surprise me was the fact that the Democrats did not turn out the vote in Milwaukee County. Had Hillary Clinton got the same level of support that Barack Obama had gotten, she would have won the state easily. So she lost more than 30,000 votes just in Milwaukee County and lost the state by about 23,000 votes. But what I did sense were two things. Number one, that Trump was appealing to a constituency that had not voted for Republicans in a very long time. He did very well in rural Wisconsin. But also, I was really struck by the way our politics has become so tribal and party loyalty has become so intense that even among many of my listeners who had really no illusions about who and what Donald Trump represented, who were offended by the same things that offended a lot of other folks, they were going to vote for him because, well, in their minds, it was a binary choice. And this meant that no matter how awful he was, he could not possibly be as bad as Hillary Clinton. And this sense of the binary choice in American politics is just driven so much of what's going on in the debate and the dialogue that we have right now. But I did get the sense that knowing people I'd worked with for 20 years or more, who had decided that that I was the apostate, that I was the traitor because I was not getting on board the Trump train, because they felt that it was so important to vote for the nominee no matter who or what he was.
So you've written that you see Trump as a cartoon version of every left-wing media stereotype of the reactionary, nativist, misogynist right. And I'm curious if that's what he is, what you think of Trump voters among your Wisconsin listenership or anyone else. Does that mean that Republican America really is more of a big basket of deplorables than you would have wanted to believe?
Well, that is an awfully interesting question. And I'll answer it two ways. I mean, obviously, you had a lot of sincere, decent people who decided to cast their vote for Donald Trump because of what they believed he was. And they really did want to see some fundamental change. But the reality is, and I think that conservatives need to come to grips with this, is that perhaps all of our allies were not who we thought they were, that perhaps there were things going on that we did not fully understand, and that perhaps we fed the beast. I'm not going to say that the vast majority of conservatives are racist or Republicans are racist. I'm not going to necessarily buy that narrative. But I will say this, that if the Republican Party and the conservative movement had been more sensitive toward racial issues, this would not have happened. A party that actually took those issues seriously and thought that these were, you know, a fundamental, you know, moral test would not have so easily embraced and enabled a Donald Trump.
My guest is Charlie Sykes. If you're just joining us, he's going to be the Wednesday night host in a new national call-in show that WNYC launches tonight called Indivisible. He's going to be, as I say, he'll be the Wednesday night host. We're going to have WNYC's Kai Wright on Mondays, co-hosting with people from The Economist from London. I'll be the Tuesday night host, Charlie Sykes on Wednesday, and Kelly Miller from Minnesota Public Radio on Thursday night. So spread the word to your friends and relatives around the country. This will be a national public radio call-in show Mondays through Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern time, for the first 100 days of the Trump administration, and that equates to 14 weeks. So next 14 Monday nights, you'll hear Kai Wright at 8 o'clock. Next 14 Tuesday nights, me. 14 Wednesday nights, Charlie and Kelly Miller from Minnesota Public Radio. The next 14 Thursday nights. There you go. Set your radio DVRs, if there is such a thing. And listeners, call in for Charlie Sykes, if you're an old Charlie Sykes listener from Wisconsin, or if you want to talk about the first 3 days of the Trump administration, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Charlie, let's you and I talk about the first few days of the administration. And let me start with that Kellyanne Conway soundbite on tax returns that we played. She said nobody cares. Do you care?
I care, and I think that the polls would suggest that the vast majority of Americans care, and even a majority of Republicans care.
Why?
Well, again, there's two things. Number one is the tradition that we've had in American politics of some sort of transparency, because we do need to know what the conflicts of interest are. We need to know a little bit about the finances of a man who rose to power, bragging about his finances. And number two, I guess I care in the sense that they clearly have just simply decided that the rules do not apply to them. And I think this is part of this new norm. And I know there are people who applaud the fact that he's shattering norms and, you know, ignoring protocols. But the way in which he has, you know, casually makes promises that he breaks ought to be disturbing, not just to people who voted against him, but for people who, in fact, kind of, you know, crossed their fingers and voted for him because they were hoping that maybe he was going to do some of the things he said he was going to do.
Is there any logical explanation for why he won't release his tax returns, or plausible explanation other than he has something serious to hide?
No, I don't think so. Anytime somebody hides something, it's because there's a reason to hide something. And the reason he is decided that he is not going to release the tax returns is, I don't want to be vulgar, but there's a reason why dogs lick themselves, you know, and because they can. He feels that he can get away with it. And I think that with this president, you know, that's going to be one of the standards. Can I get away with it? Will there be any consequences? And you really saw rather bluntly and nakedly Kellyanne Conway basically saying, we're not going to do it because who's going to make us?
Yeah. Richard Nixon did not release his returns in his 1968 and 1972 elections. I read, as I was reviewing some of the history on this, and it looks like when Watergate put a lot of pressure on him, he did release them later in 1973, and they showed that he owed $400,000 in unpaid taxes. So maybe that's an indication of why a president might withhold tax returns.
Well, and in Trump's case, there are so many possibilities, including he's essentially conceded that despite being a billionaire, allegedly, that he doesn't pay, that he has not paid any taxes whatsoever, which would, of course, cut against the populist message. We don't know what his ties are with Russian businesses. And of course, as David Fahrenthold from The Washington Post had documented so brilliantly during the campaign, I think it might not be a flattering portrait of his charitable giving either.
Have you looked at Trump's executive order on Obamacare? It's pretty cryptic. It says his agency should act to the maximum extent permitted by law to ease burdens from Obamacare on individuals, businesses, state governments, and others. Now, since the requirements or burdens of Obamacare are federal law that Congress would have to repeal, is it clear to you what this order will actually do, or is this just a marketing announcement?
Brian, actually, I was really glad to hear your introduction a few minutes ago, because I was afraid you were going to ask me about this, because my reaction was the same as yours, which was that it was completely incomprehensible. I actually tried to ask a couple of people, what does this mean? Well, it could mean the beginning of the unraveling. Well, it could mean this. The reality is that really nobody knows. And in this country, when you actually have a law, the president of the United States should not be able to sign a piece of paper that simply negates the law. I'm a critic of Obamacare, but I had the same reaction that you had, is that I found it incredibly cryptic and incredibly confusing and not terribly enlightening.
All right. We'll go through some more of the first 3-day actions by the Trump administration as we go here with Charlie Sykes. Let's start folding in some callers on our absolutely full board with people calling from politically all over the map, and we'll start with Peter in Brooklyn. Peter, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, he stated that it's not a binary choice, but as far as the presidential election goes, there were really only two viable candidates. So how do you justify writing in Evan McMullen when in the end it's going to be Trump or Clinton? In Utah, he had a chance, so that could have made a difference. But anywhere else, it wouldn't have.
And so, even in Utah, which McMullen could have carried, if he got those electoral votes, the result would have been to make a Clinton presidency more likely, not an Evan McMullen presidency. And of course, Charlie, we heard the same argument on the left. President Obama was going around the last few weeks of the campaign saying, hey, look, a vote for the Libertarian Party candidate or the Green Party candidate or anyone might as well be a vote for Donald Trump. So when you said to your conservative listeners in Wisconsin, it's not a binary choice, maybe really it was.
Well, it's, I've had this conversation many, many times, both on the air and within my family, Peter, so just so you know. And ultimately, it came down to this, that I could not control the outcome of the election. All I could control was what I was going to do. And, you know, I had a sense that, you know, there is, of course, the argument to vote for the lesser of two evils, but you're still voting for somebody who is, quote unquote, an evil. And quite frankly, you know, I wanted to come out of this to be able to say, look, you know, I did not compromise principles by voting for somebody that I found to be, you know, completely contrary to what I actually believe. So, you know, I certainly understood the argument about being binary, but the problem of that binary choice is it demands that you ignore everything else, that everything is at stake. And I'm afraid that what's been happening in American politics, it's part of this polarization where it's all or nothing. And if you buy into the sort of the tribal binary view of politics, then whatever your guy does not matter, that you have to overlook character, you have to overlook deception, you have to overlook all of that. And frankly, I just made the decision I wasn't going to buy into that.
Howard in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Howard, thanks a lot for calling. Good morning.
Good morning. I love your show.
Thank you.
Just very curious. I'm sorry, your guest's name again?
Charlie Sykes.
Yeah, Charlie Sykes. It's just very curious because I have driven across the country six times, and I know the country pretty well. And for him to say that conservatives aren't prejudiced, I just find it really curious, where in the Obama administration totally proved that. You know, when the guy shouted at the first State of the Union address, when another senator called him a tar baby, connecting Obama with the declining economy, and the fact that when Trent Lott was Senate Majority Leader, he said America would have been better if Strom Thurmond was president. So I do not understand how he makes that statement. I just don't get it. It's not true, and it's not being honest.
The statement that the majority of Republicans are not racist, Charlie, he's referring to what you said earlier.
Yeah, well, I'm not denying that there are not racists out there, and Trent Lott was forced out of that position. So, you know, here's the distinction that I'm trying to make here, is that, first of all, you know, I would suggest that people on both sides stop the generalization, stop the stereotyping, stop the insulting of people who may disagree with you. Look, I am certainly not denying that there's a problem of racism and prejudice, and I don't think that conservatives did a good enough job calling it out. I've actually written that we did not push back hard enough against the birthers. We did not push back hard enough against some of the bizarre conspiracy theorists. Maybe we turned a blind eye to people who, in fact, were opposed to President Obama because of his race. But, you know, it would, I think, help us move forward if we also acknowledge that there are principled differences, that not everybody is motivated by the same sort of thing. And certainly, most of the people that I have dealt with disagreed with the president on fiscal issues or in constitutional matters. But I did say this before, that had, you know, our movement been more sensitive to this issue, I don't think this would have happened. But, you know, the finger pointing that all conservatives are blank is as wrong as saying all members of any other group think alike or have the same characteristics.
Nathan in Flatbush, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, Brian, thanks for taking my call. And Charlie, I'm originally from kind of your listening area, from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, so I'm pretty well acquainted with your, you know,
with your
listener base.
So Nathan, what are we getting ourselves into here?
Well, I mean, I think we're getting ourselves into a mess, and I want to talk about this Sean Spicer thing because I think people are talking about it all wrong. I think that they deliberately went out there and threw some red meat in the form of some really salacious, provably not true statements, so that the media would spend the next week scratching its eyes out about something that doesn't matter while they're in the background dismantling, you know, our social programs, our regulatory system. I think the whole thing is very deliberate and planned, and that it's just a big smokescreen so that we don't actually pay attention to what they're doing.
I completely agree with that, by the way, and I was going to say so when we got to that section with Charlie. But, Charlie, what do you think?
Well, I go back and forth on this. Sometimes I think that we attribute things to the Trump administration or to Donald Trump, sort of like the remember the movie Being There with Peter Sellers, and he's Chauncey Gardner, and he says things, and everybody thinks it's deeply profound.
He was a vidiot, somebody became an idiot by just watching TV and nothing else. For years when he was locked a lock in, right? That's the Chauncey Gardner character in that movie.
Exactly. It sounds very, very familiar. I understand the point that the caller is making here. I think that what you saw there was the lack of impulse control on the part of this administration. There's a fascinating report in the New York Times this morning how other aides were saying, listen, don't do this. Do not put your press secretary out on his first day to share a brazen lie. But I do think there's something important going on here. I take the caller's point, but I do think there's something going on here that's more important than the crowd sizes, because really, ultimately, who cares what the crowd sizes were? What matters is whether or not this administration cares about what is true and what is factual. That on one level, he's waging a war against the media, which of course plays well to his base. On another war, this is a president who is quite literally waging a war on facts and truth. We had a post-truth campaign, and now we have an alternative factual presidency. And I think that
that's a reference for people who didn't happen to watch Meet the Press yesterday, to Kellyanne Conway on that show, talking about these false statements that the press secretary Sean Spicer was making about crowd size, and she said he had alternative facts. So go ahead.
Which is fantastic. I mean, it really is. It is kind of Orwellian, and I think that this alternative reality media that has been created out there, which I think has created Donald Trump, is also something that people need to understand, that you actually now have a president who I honestly believe is setting out to delegitimize both the media. To delegitimize independent sources of fact and accountability. That imagine a president of the United States who honestly thinks that no matter what is discovered about him, no matter what investigative reporters come up with, that it will not penetrate, that he doesn't have to pay any attention, that he will have a base of voters that either will believe everything he says or will get to the point of thinking the truth is in fact unknowable. That what is truth? Are there such things as facts, or do you have your facts and we have our alternative facts? We're actually in a very, very strange moment here. And so I agree that obviously this was a distraction from much more substantive things that were happening, but it is it will have long-term implications.
And a distraction, I thought, specifically from how big the attendance was globally at the women's marches. So instead of talking about how big they demonstrably were, people were on CNN and stuff were obsessing over how big or how small the Trump inauguration crowds were. But you also tweeted, I saw, a column this morning by New York Times conservative columnist Ross Douthat, urging reporters basically not to sink to his level, a column called The Tempting of the Media. And you wrote that it was important. Why did you find that column important for the press?
Well, I think that one of the crises of the media is this crisis of credibility. And I think that they need to understand to the extent to what extent they might have contributed to eroding their own credibility by either having double standards or by reporting things that are not true. So part of what has to happen is that we have to reestablish the credibility of responsible outlets out there. This is essential. And the point he made in that column is don't take the bait by becoming, I think the phrase was, hysterically oppositional, which is don't just throw everything up against the wall. Don't keep the dial at outrage all the time. Otherwise, what will happen is that you will, in fact, start to you'll feed into this narrative that the Trump folks would love, that in fact you're going to publish anything. For example, I think BuzzFeed's decision to dump out that unsubstantiated dossier really played into Trump's hands, and it played into the notion that they've actually now hijacked, that this was fake news.
If you're just joining us, folks, my guest is Charlie Sykes, a new member of the WNYC family, the longtime Wisconsin talk show host, and Charlie's going to be hosting the Wednesday night edition of our first 100 days of the Trump administration national call-in show called Indivisible. And if this is the first you're hearing about it, this is going to be Monday through Thursday nights in the 8 o'clock Eastern Time hour for the first 14 weeks or 100 days of the Trump administration. We're going to have different hosts on different nights of the week. WNYC's Kai Wright, along with a co-host from The Economist in London on Monday nights, me on Tuesday nights, Charlie Sykes on Wednesday nights, and Kelly Miller from Minnesota Public Radio on Thursday nights. So that's a new national call-in that we are producing in the 8 o'clock Eastern Time hour, Monday through Thursday nights, beginning tonight with Kai Wright and a co-host from The Economist in London. Then me tomorrow, Charlie on Wednesday, Kelly Miller on Thursday, and for the next 14 weeks to be called Indivisible. And we're talking with Charlie now about the first 3 days of the Trump administration. And Gail in Buffalo, you're on WNYC. Gail, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Good morning, both of you. I have two quick points. Ryan, first of all, Kelly tweeted out this morning, guess what, that Trump will release his taxes once they're out of audit. So, I mean, it's confusing. Keep them laughing. Keep them confused.
Okay.
So,
yes. I'll have to go
which I think seems
look
into the
for that.
You're saying.
All right.
Second, Charlie, I was confused. You said, on one hand, that the Milwaukee vote was 30,000 less for Hillary, and if Democrats had gone for Hillary the way they went for Obama, she would have won. On the other hand, you immediately pivoted to party loyalty. And saying that it was binary and people went with their parties. So I don't quite get that, unless it was just loyalty on the Republican side, not the Democrats.
Well, actually, both of those things were true. I mean, I actually thought I thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win in Wisconsin and predicted. So I was wrong, like a lot of other people were. I'd assumed that the Democratic vote would come out. He actually underperformed in my area in southeastern Wisconsin. A lot of Republicans, you know, were not supportive. But again, what I did not anticipate was that he was going to get 80 plus percentage of the Republican vote. Remember, in Wisconsin, he was very, very unpopular. In southeastern Wisconsin, right before the Republican primary, his approval rating among Republicans was about 26%. I want you to think about that. He had a 26% approval rating among Republicans in southeastern Wisconsin. His disapproval rating was over 60%. And yet, in the end, most Republicans came out and voted for Donald Trump. That's the point I was trying to make. This coming home, this tribalism, this sense that, okay, he may be awful, he may be a demagogue, he may be a con man, he may be, you know, all of these things. He may be a racist, sexist, I mean, despite, you know, the Access Hollywood video. In the end, they went into the voting booth and they voted for him anyway.
Rakesh on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rakesh.
Hello, first time, long time. Mr. Sykes, I grew up in southeastern Wisconsin, Waukesha County in the 80s and 90s, and I listened to your show with my parents quite a bit. Now, when I remember growing up in Wisconsin, we had Senators Cole and Feingold, and I remember it being a very liberal place. However, listening to your show over the years, you know, with the rise of Scott Walker, the destruction of public unions out there, the segregation, the police brutality, you didn't say anything about these things, and I find you to be a representative of the rising Tea Party stride that took place in that state past 2008. And now I listen to you coming out and talking about, you know, these stances you want to take against Donald Trump after you were, you know, kicked out of this conservative movement because of how you spoke. And I'm wondering how you actually atone for being a part of this process.
If atone is what you do.
Well, you know, I think part of what I've been very, very open in saying is that I wanted to step back and say, okay, to what extent did I contribute to this? What did I miss? What did I say things that I intended in one way that were heard another way? By the way, the caller is not wrong. I mean, I did support many of the things that he is describing. So, but now you have to ask, okay, you know, is there a direct line between many of those things and what we're seeing with Donald Trump? I mean, I would like to argue. I would like to argue that there is not a continuity, but I have to admit that, in fact, we probably did contribute to that. So I don't know whether or not the tone is the right word, but here I am on public radio talking about these things and confessing that perhaps we had made mistakes. We did not fully understand what our movement was or who our allies were.
were you a fan, are you a fan of the Tea Party or what's now called, I guess, the Freedom Caucus within the House of Representatives?
That's a complicated question. In fact, I'm working on a book right now, and I'm actually this week I'm working on my chapter on whatever happened to the Tea Party. I think I was initially sympathetic to what they were talking about, but I think they took a wrong turn in a couple of ways. I think the rhetoric, I think the tactics became extreme. I think they indulged in reckless rhetoric. Then, of course, they were essentially hijacked by a variety of scam packs, charlatans, fakes, and phonies. So after a while, the big question was, who are you people? What do you actually stand for? What was this movement? So in a lot of ways, the Tea Party is emblematic of how the conservative movement went wrong, that you start off with something that is perhaps genuine and grassroots, and then is co-opted by people who take that agenda and turn it into something that was often quite ugly and often quite irresponsible. And I think that the Freedom Caucus, you mentioned the Freedom Caucus seems more anxious to stake out a position of ideological purity than to actually accomplish anything, which again is one of the problems that I think the conservative movement has to confront, which is that it's one thing to rail and be outraged and to be paranoid. It's another thing to actually be serious about the business of governing.
So how do you think, as a matter of political analysis, that the Freedom Caucus, trying to be ideologically pure, felt about Donald Trump's inaugural address, which he started with, the populist call to basically reject both parties in the establishment in Washington?
Well, I'm going to fasten. I don't know the answer to that question. And I am absolutely fascinated by watching how real conservatives in Washington are going to react to Donald Trump. I mean, so far right now, I think there's a lot of bowing of the knee, pulling of the forelocks, mm-hmm.
right.
and saying, you're the maximum leader. But will they draw the line and say, no, we got elected as well, saying that we are a small government or fiscally conservative figures. So we're not necessarily going to give you a blank check. But I see no indication so far, none, that conservatives in Congress are willing to stand up to him or push back on him. But we'll see shortly whether they're willing to do that.
I want to play one clip from the speech, and those of you who cringe when you hear Donald Trump's voice, bear with me on this because it raises an issue. Critics were saying the speech was divisive, whereas most inaugural addresses stress unity. And the Trump people were apoplectic by that analysis being so common, and they vigorously denied it. So I want to play a one-minute section of the speech that they point to and get your reaction.
It's time to remember that old wisdom our soldiers will never forget, that whether we are black or brown or white, we all bleed the same red blood of patriots. We all enjoy the same glorious freedoms, and we all salute the same great American flag. And whether a child is born in the urban sprawl of Detroit or the windswept plains of Nebraska, they look up at the same night sky, they fill their heart with the same dreams, and they are infused with the breath of life by the same almighty Creator. So to all Americans in every city near and far, small and large, from mountain to mountain, from ocean to ocean, hear these words. You will never be ignored again.
Donald Trump from his inaugural address. So, Charlie, even though it had that seemingly belligerent tone that he takes so often, it wasn't the warm blanket of Obama or Reagan kind of oratory, were the words not there?
No, I mean, that was some – I mean, how can you not like that? On the other hand, I guess I would go back to Kellyanne Conway, that we need to take him seriously and not literally. You know, we're told on some occasions we need to take his words literally, and this is who he is. And other times we're reassured that whatever he says doesn't really matter. Look, anyone can read anything that somebody has written for him on a teleprompter. The question is, what does he do? And I think this is ultimately a president that is going to be evaluated by his actions. Here's a guy who gives that speech, which was those were great sentiments. And then he puts Steve Bannon next to him in the White House, the former CEO of Breitbart, who's bragged that he provided a platform for the alt-right, which is basically white nationalism. So there's always the contrast between what he says and then what he actually does.
All right. So we're going to leave it there for now. And I think you're right. We need to judge this president on his actions. The words are almost meaningless because he'll say whatever he
Correct.
Needs to say to get him over for the next 5 minutes politically. And there's so many contradictions when we go back and look at them. And so we will literally have to judge him on his actions seriously. So just give us a little preview of Wednesday night, your first show in our national call-in series, Indivisible. What are you planning?
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to try to introduce myself to an audience that probably has not heard people from my particular political persuasion very often. Try to explain what I mean by being a contrarian conservative and maybe answer some of the questions that you asked me in the beginning. You know, why did I take the position that I took? And what is it like being a conservative in the era of Donald Trump? But what I really want to do is I want to get a sense from people across the political spectrum, like, how are you reacting to what's going on here? I mean, these are remarkable times. There is, you know, a remarkable emotional and intellectual turmoil going on. And I'm most interested in hearing about how people are responding. Are they hopeful? Are they worried? Are they terrified? And then let's begin a dialogue.
Charlie Sykes, late of WTMJ in Milwaukee, now for the next 14 weeks or first 100 days, which is what our series is intended to encompass, of the Trump administration, the Wednesday night host in the national call-in show that we're producing called Indivisible. Charlie, thanks so much for coming on this morning. I'm looking forward to hearing you on Wednesday.
Brian, thank you so much.
And again, that series will air Monday through Thursday nights for the first 100 days of the Trump administration with different hosts on each night. Our Kai Wright with co-hosts from The Economist in London on Monday night. So that starts tonight at 8 o'clock. Me on Tuesday nights at 8. Charlie on Wednesday nights. And Carrie Miller, I apologize to her because I mistakenly said Kelly Miller. Maybe I had Kellyanne for some reason, that name on the brain. But it's Carrie Miller from Minnesota Public Radio who's going to be the Thursday night host in the Indivisible series, Thursday nights at 8. So in addition to the mornings, I'll be talking to you Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock as well and the other hosts on the other nights. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we're going to talk to Zephyr Teachout from the Fordham Law School about a lawsuit that she and others will be filing against the Trump administration today. Here we are. It's day 4. They're filing suit saying that he's violating the Constitution. Stay with us.